welcome to Center for Victory's podcast of your best day yet. At Center for Victory, we're here to help unlock, reinforce, and enrich relationships through personal and professional development. I'm Eric Guy, Chief Victory Officer at the Center for Victory. With me today, very special guest, Mr. John Brink. Thanks for being on the show. I'm going to introduce you just a little bit, but John has a very fascinating story that's going to resonate with all of you. I can't get enough. I keep reading more and more. I just got introduced to him and I just keep reading more and more about him. And he just told me he's got another book coming out in July of 2024. I'm interested in the one that just came out this past July in 2023. But John was actually born in Nazi-occupied Holland at the beginning of the Second World War. From the time he could walk, his days often consisted of foraging for food with his brother and sister. His mother was left to raise the three kids alone when their father was drafted into the Dutch army. They wouldn't know if he was alive until the liberation of their village by Canadian soldiers on April 12th, 1945. So this was the exact moment John determined he would make his life in Canada, the land of his heroes, which is kind of neat. And he was only 5 years old at that time. So you did immigrate to Canada in July of 1965, John, with just a little money in your pocket. But I want to really get into this, so I'm gonna cut a little bit of this out, John. But you are a strong supporter and have been of education and trades. So the John A. Brink Trades and Technology Center at the College of New Caledonia was established in 2005. Recognizing John's contributions of $500,000, John provides in excess of $500,000 in financial resources to more than 50 charities annually. My kind of guy, a real giver. He sponsored hundreds of Canadian athletes in all age categories from amateur to Olympic level. He's a strong supporter of the Special Olympics. And get this, folks, and we're going to talk about this, John. He's the oldest nationally ranked bodybuilder in North America. If you look this dude up on, you know, on the internet, now keep in mind, if you did the math, you're 83, correct, John?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, he's 83. He's still bodybuilding, still in the gym every day. Exactly. He's got lots of books out, but his most recent one that I want to get into is Finding Your Passion, Living the Dream. But let's go ahead maybe and just give him a teaser at the end here, John, for your new one coming out in July 2024, Living Young, Dying Old. So, John, that was a mouthful, but welcome to the show, my friend.
Well, thank you, Eric. Thanks for the introduction. Appreciate that.
Yeah. So you've been on quite the journey. You know, I guess we should probably start with this, just the question, what was it like growing up, you know, in World War II in Nazi-occupied Holland?
Well, I was born November the 1st, 1940. So already my mother was pregnant with me then, and my dad had been drafted that same year, 1940, into the Dutch army. And the last time they heard from him was just before the bombing of Rotterdam, and he was downtown Rotterdam. Rotterdam is a big city in Holland, and the Germans wanted to expedite the Dutch giving up. And in order to do that, they bombed the downtown of Rotterdam, and thousands of people were killed in the process. So from there on in, my mom was on her own. And the first remembering that I have from the Second World War was when I was 3.5, 4 years old. And in the mornings, daytime, nighttime, we would have hundreds of bombers in the air. That was after the landing in Normandy by the Allied forces and had pushed their way through Europe and at the same time started bombing very heavily in Germany, in particular the areas that were manufacturing a lot of the support systems for their wars across Europe. And I was born in, as you indicated, in Holland, but in the northeastern part of Holland, the very northeast, about 10, 15 minutes away from the German border and close to where the North Sea touches the northern part of Holland and Germany. So what we used to do is my mother, in particular in the nighttime when the bombers were flying overhead, a sound that I still know today. There's nothing like it. Hundreds of bombers in the air. She would take us outside and on a flat roof behind our house, not to watch the beauty of planes, but because he felt safer outside than inside. And then in the distance, we would see German cities burning, red all in the distance. And as they would come back, there was obviously lots of dogfights over the areas. And we saw numerous planes coming down over the years that followed. And then the next thing that happened, obviously the winter that I remember well, 1944, 1945, was the coldest in history that had happened down there. And at the same time, the Germans had cut off all the food supply to those areas of most of Holland, actually, and before the winter of 1944, 45. So in the mornings, my brother, 2 years older than me, my sister, 1 year older, and myself, we would take gunny sacks and go into the railroad yards and pick up anything edible and burnable. And the reason that we did as kids is because the Germans would boot us one in our back end, but they wouldn't shoot us. And then we'd just come back the following day. So, and then I still, even today, Eric, still can feel the feeling of hunger. I can still feel it. And then the extreme cold, we only had one little stove that was burning in the whole house, and we had a small room, and we sit around the stove, and I still feel even the cold. And where that today is 40 below here in the Prince George region where I am now, it was extremely cold there then in that part of Holland. And that part still stays with me. And the other part that followed me is anxiety of losing that one parent. And much later, I know that I had, as a result of all of this and being around it and seeing far too much when we were liberated by the Canadians, you know, that we saw far too much that we should not have seen. And I was affected by PTSD, which stays with you your whole life. And then the other part was that I was affected by the inner child, or the fear of losing that parent. In fact, got counseling for it well into my 50s. Very emotional. And, you know, so, but the one part that you already alluded to in the introduction is that I was so impressed by the liberating forces, the Canadians, that I always knew from that point forward, I belonged in Canada and I would go to Canada. That's where I wanted to live, the land of my heroes.
When did you go to Canada?
I emigrated. I wanted to go when I was 17, and then my parents wouldn't let me in. So I was then drafted in the Dutch Air Force. Well, I was in the Dutch Air Force for 30 months in special forces, actually. And then after that, I worked in a job in the forest industry. My dad was managing a small lumber company, and I worked for a big company, but I still had that dream of going to Canada. And then the other part I have to just add to it is I was not very successful academically. I failed grade 3 and I failed grade 7 three times. And I always kind of, in a way, I felt that I had failed. And a lot of my friends that used to be my friends, when they said after the third time failing grade 7, they said, what are we going to do with this guy? Do we send him to the mentally challenged school, or do we get him a trade of some sort? Fortunately, my parents were beautiful people. They decided to make me a furniture maker. And so they sent me to a furniture factory. I was not even quite 14 yet. And then in the evenings, I would go to learning the trade of becoming a furniture maker. And during the daytime, I worked in a furniture store and in a factory. And so then when I was 23, I decided now was the time to go to Canada. I went to the Dutch, the Canadian immigration office in Holland, and they must have had an opening then, because I wanted to go within 3 weeks. I hadn't even told my parents about it. And so that's what I did. I applied to for immigration status. And then the other part about it, Eric, I wanted to start with nothing. I took one suitcase, two sets of clothes, and three books, and I took 150 Canadian dollars, and that's all I had with me when I left for Canada.
Yeah, and then it says when you arrived, is this true, the $25.47?
When I arrived initially by plane in Montreal, took the train across Canada, 4 days, five nights. My God, it's a big country. And then I landed in Vancouver, and I couldn't speak the language. I didn't know a soul. I didn't have a job. So I went to the immigration office in Vancouver. And, so fortunately, there was a German fellow working there, and I could speak some German. So I told them what I wanted to do. He said to me, Prince George, go to Prince George. That's a booming town, lots of lumber industry. And because I told them what I wanted to do, my dream was coming to Canada, and my second dream was to prove to myself that I could do it just as well as my friends that had at school that had gone to college and university, and that I had the qualities and the ability to become successful as well. And then by the time I got off the bus, as you said, and actually my employees made this for me, I had exactly $25.47. But I had plenty of is attitude. No matter how tough today is, I swear it will be a better day tomorrow. And then the other thing that I have is passion. Whatever I do, I give it 150%. And then the last one is part of my foundation is work ethic. I work harder than anybody. What follows is success. And so that's the way I feel about things, and that's the approach that I took.
That's awesome. I like that. Love that sign. Yeah, that's great stuff. So you had mentioned, and I know, you know, you've been successful. You've run, I think, what, 10 plus companies, right. have achieved a high degree of wealth, but there was still that feeling of failure for most of your life. Am I correct?
Correct.
What was that like, and how did you deal with it? How are you dealing with it?
So what would happen is that, you know, I still had that feeling of failure. That's why I left Holland in a way. I wanted to go to the land of my heroes, but the other one is wanting to prove to me. A lot of times kids are hard on each other, right? So all my friends that went up to college, university, and careers, and I became what they called a laborer. I'm proud of that today, but then it was kind of looked down at. And, so it was important for me to kind of at least to prove to me that I could do it. So when starting from nothing here, and then from there on in, started out as a cleanup man, then lumber pilot, and within a year and a half, I was already a superintendent of one of the larger mills here. And then within 10 years, I had already a variety of companies. And everybody would say to me, hey, John, you should write a book about that. And all the, but I didn't really feel that way in a way. But, I started writing on the book, tried it out again, and all the other things. But the other part that affected me adversely because of all of this likely is, Eric, I was not a very good communicator. I could, in my own companies, although they were quite successful, interact with three, four people or four or five maybe. But outside of that, I was not very good at interacting. And then what happened is that an ex-sister-in-law that I had is and still have actually is she mentioned to me at one time, hey, John, I want to take you with me to Toastmasters. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with Toastmasters.
Yeah, yes.
An amazing organization. I said, what did you do there? And she said, well, they help people in becoming better communicators. And I said, are they going to ask me any questions? She said, no, you just sit there and you watch it. And if you like it, go back. And if you don't, you don't. So, and I said, as long as nobody asked me any questions, no, it's no question. Halfway through the meeting, somebody stood up and said, "Hey, John, tell us something about you." And I said, "Oh my God, I'll never go back here." But I did. And I stayed there for 10 years and I reached the highest level in Toastmasters, which is a distinguished Toastmasters.
Wow.
And for the benefit of our guests watching, it's not only becoming good speakers, but Toastmasters is also becoming good listeners. And even more importantly, you learn to become good at thinking on your feet. As part of this very structured organization, I think around North America, probably there is 450,000 people, as we speak, part of clubs in their towns that are participating in Toastmasters. And then probably around the world, probably up to 1 million or more, 10 million maybe even, have participated in some form to help and improve their ability, communication ability. They don't necessarily stay there for 10 years or go through the highest level. For me, it was very important to change my life, actually. And distinguished Toastmasters, there's probably less than 1% of them that have gone to that level. For me, it changed everything. And, you know, became a good speaker after that and an in-demand speaker. And obviously, I'm doing podcasting. But the other thing that it did also, it gave me the confidence, and then I became a writer. And now the other thing that I have to add to it as well, Eric, to put it into perspective, is that so the warriors laid a foundation that always stayed with me. The dream of going to the land of my heroes, Canada, played a major role. Becoming part of Toastmasters, unlocking me and the self-confidence. And then the other part played a major role for me is that it was in 1997, January 1997, that I walked into a store here in Prince George. And for some reason or another, I still don't know why, I picked up this book, and the book's title was Driven to Distraction. It was about ADHD. And I said, "Oh my God, that's me." And I took that book, I bought it, I wrote in the book in Dutch because I was ashamed of it. Now I finally know who I am. And it was written by Dr. Holliwell, an amazing writer. He was on my podcast actually just today. And, you know, so, and we had an amazing conversation, but he changed my life in addition to the other things. So now all of a sudden it unlocked, in fact, as to who am I? And so initially I started looking at Google. Now we are in 1997. It was not so well known yet. Right. And as I searched more and more, explain to me why I was academically not very successful, because the traditional system of teaching is I become easily bored and distracted. And to sit 4 years in the classroom didn't work for me. I like things that I'm interested in. And it was even to the extent I could be sitting all day in the classroom. And if you would ask me the following day, tell us a little bit about what you talked about, I have no idea. You know, so, and the more I learned about it, now this was 1997, then it took me 5 years before I even went to my doc, who was a personal friend, delivered our two daughters, and was a personal friend. And I walked into his office in 2002, and he said, "Hey, John, why are you here?" I said, "I think I got ADHD. And we looked at it and discussed, and I do. And so it took me probably up to about 6, 7 years ago, and I'm 83 now, well into my 60s and 70s, before I became more and more public about it, because I believe that the frequency of occurrence, and I talked to Dr. Holliwell about that as well, just today in our podcast, is that it was believed that about 8% of the population are affected or benefited from ADHD. It probably is closer to 20 or 25%. Of the population. And, you know, and then it probably is 50% or better of the successful entrepreneurs that have ADHD. It could be as high as 75%. In fact, we hired a senior person for one of our companies, I have about 10 different, it's not about me and the success that I, you know, the point that I'm going to make, we hired one, we published it on a national level, and we wrote on that ADHD considered to be an asset. So the other part about it, that I felt I had to write a book about it. So I did. Mm-hmm. This one I wrote, ADHD Unlocked. And it's written by an ADHD mind. So you can pick it up anywhere, go either this way or the other way, you know. And it's very interesting, very, very successful. And I'm not the only one that wrote it, but Dr. Halliwell, an amazing, amazing individual.
Yeah.
What's on the Brain podcast with him? Amazing. So... So that's what I did, and you know, then again, the other one is now coming back to those elements in terms of, okay, how did I get to all of this? I had to fill in those particular gaps. So now we are saying, okay, I become feeling better. Now it explained to me why academically I was not overly successful, although I was a very good writer and I was very good at numbers. And mm-hmm. and so about 5-6 years ago, well into my mid-70s again, I again coming back to, you should write a book about that. I had stopped. Writing books is not easy. And
no, it's not.
and so what I did is I thought, if I don't do it now, it will never happen. So I started to write. The first book that I did is Against All Odds. And it's a autobiography, and as you well know, autobiography, you cannot do it as a training piece and then once you're done, you have it for a while and then you say, "Ma, I don't like it, I'll do another one." No, you get one shot at an autobiography.
Yeah.
This is the one. And so it is not about how successful John is. That's not what it's about. It's all the ups and downs along the way, and it's become very, very successful. Now, the other thing that I should just add, Eric, to it is that I don't know if you can see it from there, but if you look at the newest one, this one, Finding Your Passion, Living the Dream, can you see what the price is on that book?
$25.47. That is awesome. Oh, I love that.
$25.47. You know, so
wonderful. Oh, that's great. I'm glad you showed me that. I just, you know, we work with a lot of companies, and I'm on the phone every day with CEOs and presidents of companies, and I would agree with that, man. Just trying to get them, you know, focused from time to time, but the benefit of that as well, the benefit that comes with, and a lot of them have, just like you and I have, you know, struggled in school, things like that. So I'm glad you brought that up and out there.
It's a superpower, Eric. That's what I'm saying to everybody. It's a superpower. I've given presentations to 500-600 people, and then by the time I'm done, because whatever I do with passion. I'm blowing my own horn somewhat, but I'm a very, very good presenter and a good speaker. By the time I'm done with them and talk about not only ADHD, but entrepreneurship and all the other things around it, then they say, "Damn, I wish I had it too."
Yeah, I agree with you. One of the things I think that, let's just stay there with kind of with entrepreneurs a little bit. What advice do you have for entrepreneurs who are either struggling or thriving? Like, you've seen a lot, right?
I've seen it all.
Yeah.
You know, so I always believe, stay the course. Don't give up. And then at the same time, surround yourself with good people, or feel free to seek advice of people that are successful. Don't be ashamed as an entrepreneur thinking that you're being successful and that you need some guidance somewhere along the line, or sitting down with another person that you respect, talk to them. And then the other part is that which already shows my thought, my direction of thought was when I left Holland, I had in my case three books. I still have those. Which ones were they, John? The one was Management by Drucker in Dutch. I nearly wore it out. And the second one was Logical Thinking in Dutch. And then the other one was All About Canada. Those were my three books. But as I always like to, even now, listen to what I perceive to be, these are not the multi-billionaires, multi-millionaires, but interesting CEOs that have the ability to think outside of the box. Because unfortunately, especially today in the world, the box is not the way it looked when you took your MBA or whatever you did. The box moves constantly. You have to be flexible, but at the same time, you have to train yourself to give yourself the ability to look outside of that. That's what makes people successful around Amazon and all of those other people that have been so immensely successful.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of your big things for you is is giving, right? You've donated millions to charities around the world. Can you help us on what's that?
It's part of my culture.
Yeah.
You have to become part of the community. You have to give back wherever you can, in whichever form you can. And here in Northern British Columbia, even when I was just piling lumber and made $2 an hour, I still always kind of participated, not financially because I didn't have anything then, but at least was part of the community. And here, obviously, and thank you for mentioning it, College of New Caledonia, I've always been part of the college. I always believed in trade and technology, and they named one of the major buildings to me, after me, the John A. Brink Trades and Technology Center. And then we have a freestanding University of Northern British Columbia here. And I was very, very involved in that. And I was honored with an honorary doctorate of laws from the University of British Columbia. Not bad for a guy who's grade seven, three times.
Yeah.
I'm just making fun of it, but I'm very actually,
So you are the oldest nationally ranked bodybuilder in North America. So at the age of 83, and you're an inspiration to me, because that's, I told you, when I get to be your age, that's what I want to be doing. I'm very health conscious. What's important for you about that body movement every day?
So I just in case you show to your guest here, that's the book that I'm doing, Living Young, Dying Old. And fitness is a very important part of that. That book is coming out in July, actually 24. So what happened, Eric, and you likely know that as well as I do, is that especially now, this time, January, at the end of the year, we always sit there as we contemplate the last year and the new year going forward. We're going to do this, that, the other thing. And that usually includes going to the gym and fitness. And then we go for 2 weeks, and then we find 100 reasons as why we can't go. And then until next year. So in my case, in 2008, I nearly died of diverticulitis. And diverticulitis ruptured and is very toxic. And I came that close. And then my wife is vegan. And I probably was not doing as well on the gym side and then on the diet side as I should. But it taught me a lesson that I have to change that. And so I started to go to the gym with a trainer, because my life is appointments from this to that, and it has to have structure. Once it does, I will usually do everything that I can to attend those meetings. So so that's what I started to do. And after being training and going to the gym for 6 or 7 years, now I'm already in my early 70s, so then mid 70s then. And somebody came to me and said, as I was training, and said, "Hey, John, have you ever thought about going and competing?" I said, "Me?" I said, "Right." And I thought, maybe I should. I thought, yeah, maybe I should. So I started then in a serious way again with my trainer, working towards competition. So in 1917, 18, I started competing in Northern British Columbia, and bodybuilding and physique. And I came in second in bodybuilding, third in physique. That's 55 and older. I was already 20 years older than them. And then that qualified me for the provincials, and I came in second in physique, third in bodybuilding, which then qualified me for the nationals and the Arnolds. And
Oh, wow.
yeah, and so, and then COVID came, and that kind of put things upside down a little bit. And so now at 83, I'm still again going to the gym and getting ready again for competing, and hopefully go to the Arnold's again. And I talked to Arnold about that already in 25, and he said, if I do, then we'll make pictures together and maybe do a little bit of training together at the same time. But so that's the objective. So it makes me the oldest competitive bodybuilder in North America.
Wonderful. And so I get this question a lot from people a little bit younger than you. And that's why I'm asking it, because I don't, I think we're always needing to grow. But since you just hit middle age here,
I like that. I want to be 120.
yeah. And what are your future goals? Like, what do you, I mean, you got a book coming out, another book in 2024. What are you doing? Like, what are you doing? What keeps you going?
I want to write at least one book a year, and then I want to, be do selectively speaking in areas, although they take a lot of time. If I do a keynote presentation somewhere in the States, then it takes a lot of time. I really like podcasting, so I'm very active in the podcasting. I think I've done about 203 or 204. We do about 15 a month, and where I am the host, and then about another six or seven where I'm the guest, and like on yours, I'm the guest. And so I'm very active there because that is a whole new field of interacting and socializing, where our podcast, as we are doing it here, and the same as mine, tens of thousands of people from around the world are watching them. So it's an amazing media. So I believe it's still at the very beginning, and it will expand further. Coming back to your question, I will keep working in the gym on being fit. My diet, I'm very conscientious of it now. I'm 80-20 vegan, and again, physically getting ready for the release of my book, Living Young, Dying Old, and talking about the more simple approach to staying fit. I'm not saying that you shouldn't necessarily go bodybuild or become an Olympian, or just half an hour a day, 20 minutes a day, staying active will keep you physically fit. If you can do more, great. If you enjoy it, even greater. But the same is diet. So many of the things, the information that we get from the medical system are so complex, so complicated. I'm trying to simplify that in that book. So
Wonderful.
coming to the books, I want to write at least one a year. And then in terms of from a company's perspective, I still believe, although that's been a tough go here for the last 4 or 5 years, to before COVID, for all of us in North America, and I'm in the lumber business. We do a lot of business in the United States, so it's been a tough go for all of us. But I still, I'm also into warehousing and logistics and real estate. So I still believe that I will double the size of my company, and I'm going to stay active there. Both my wife, myself, are into horses. We both ride English dressage. So I intend to stay very, very active in a number of areas, and then be an inspiration to younger people in terms of entrepreneurship and opportunity. And for those people that there are so many that are challenged these days, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote this book, you know, like you know, finding your passion, living the dream. And so many people that I know of don't really like what they are doing. In fact, I saw a program on CNN or one of the other ones, I forget now, but they said in the United States, 70% of the people that work don't like their jobs, and 75% of the 70% are looking for another job. And then, so when I give presentations to young people in particular, he said, the sooner you kind of start, I said, you know what you're going to do after you're done with high school, university? He said, I don't know. And I said, well, start finding out, you know, maybe you want to be a welder. Maybe you want to be a truck driver. Maybe you want to be a lawyer. Maybe you want to talk to the people that do this, like entrepreneurs. A lot of people think, oh, they probably don't want to talk to anybody. Try to talk to them, invite them. They love to share their experiences. So that kind of a thing. And that is one of the reasons that I wrote the book, is that to get that inspiration. And saying a fair question would be, so John, after you've been, since I was barely 14 or 13, actually, since I've been in the workplace for 70 years, are you living the dream? Yes, I am, even still today. I usually get up early in the morning at 5:30. I always think I'm late. And then I always make my bed. And, you know, so, you know, and I'm always in a hurry. And I still do that today. And, you know, so the key is the, how do you look forward? Do more of it. Be part of culture. Give back to your community. Just always have to be hundreds of thousands of, it's not that. It's the thought and the mindset that that's my community and I'm part of it. Whatever you can do, be part of it. The other part that is important for me, Eric, for obvious reasons, that we are so fortunate if we look around the world where we live, in the United States or in Canada, in North America, where there is wars in Europe, the Ukraine, you know, for one, and with Russia, obviously. And then now looking at the Middle East, Yemen, and all the other things that we're seeing, we are so fortunate here living in a democratic system. And it is, but I say to people, do not, and I know it from experience, do not take it for granted. Everything can change overnight. And all you have to look, if you want to get the experience of dictatorships, go for a while to Russia, go to North Korea, go to Venezuela, go to Cuba, go to Yemen, for that matter, or Iran. And saying that our democratic system may be flawed in areas, and I'm not only talking about Canada, but I'm very familiar with the United States, that from time to time you come close to dictatorships, that's not where you want to be. And if for those people that watch wars and have the illusion or the thought that if there is war, then when your war is over, everything goes back to normal. No, that's not the way it is. And I'm an example of that. That can take generations, not only one, more generations. We are still the effects of war, PTSD, the inner child, and all the other things that go with it are part of it. So every time I fly in a plane, which I do a lot of, right across North America, I sit by the window and I look outside. And I say, I live in paradise. It is paradise. And so, you know, and all the other stuff and all the politics that goes with it, but fear for dictatorships, where the politics becomes too demanding and too controlling, and all of a sudden everything will change, and it can happen rapidly. Same as war. Things can fall apart from even not from the outside, but also from within. So what I say, not being political in any form, but appreciate every single day as to what we have, because we are the fortunate one. Most of the world around us, billions of people, live on less than $2 a day as income. And we have the land of plenty, you know.
I'm going to end it there, John, because that was great advice. I'm going to end it on there and hope that you'll be back to give us a little bit more later on in 2024 with your new book. Again, he's got one book that just came out. Again, the Finding Your Passion, Living the Dream, that just came out. And then the one that's coming out in 2024 is Living Young, Dying Old. And John, thank you for being an inspiration. Hopefully we can have you back on the show, because this has been very inspirational to me. I can't imagine what it'll do for our listeners as well. So thank you very much.
It was a pleasure, Eric. Thank you very much for being part of your show.
Yeah, that's all for today, folks. Thanks for listening and watching. Be sure to visit us at centerforvictory.com. And remember, wherever you're at, whatever you're doing, make this your best day yet. We'll see you soon.